Well, good evening, everybody. Thanks for coming. It's a good turnout to see. I'm Tom Abbott, the station manager at KFSK, for those of you that don't know me. We're very happy to have Peter Kenyon here with us tonight. Peter's been visiting here on his vacation, very generous enough to offer up this talk tonight while he's supposed to be relaxing and on vacation. So Peter was the 1984, 1985, close, reporter at KFSK, then went on to the Alaska Public Radio Network. You were hosting there later, and then from there moved on to National Public Radio. For the last 10 years, he's been the Mideast correspondent there, and that's the topic of the talk tonight, but we can go elsewhere, and I'm certain Peter will take your questions too, but a welcome to Peter.
Well, thanks. It was actually the fall of 1981 that I got here, and I only point that out because it makes me pre-permanent fund dividend by at least a couple of months, so my one claim to Alaskan there. But thanks to Tom for organizing this, and of course KFSK has a special place for me. A few of you might have heard how I got my start. I wandered up those steps going above the old high school gym, which is where the radio station used to be then, and I walked in and Bill Legere was the news director, and the friend I had come with went off to do her show, and this woman came marching up to me, the program director, the formidable Katie Sloan, and she said, "Do you know classical music?" And I said, "Well, Beethoven? Good, show up Sunday morning, you're a classical music host." So that was how I got my start in classical music and radio. And then a few months later, I found out that a young man had married a woman from El Salvador, and so I marched over with this big heavy cassette player and talked to her about what it was like to live in San Salvador with Dawisan and the death squads and their civil war, and spent all night trying to put that together into some kind of a radio story. I've never heard it again since, but it was so. Actually, my first story was a foreign story, then followed by many years of fishing news. But for about, it's been 10 years now, a little more. I've been covering the Middle East, first from Jerusalem and then from Cairo, and now fortunate enough to live in Istanbul, which is a wonderful city. You're all invited. And this year, we became the story, this region, just kind of unexpectedly. The Arab Spring is something that, as someone who'd lived the previous 6 years in Egypt, I can tell you nobody was expecting it there, neither the leaders nor the people on the street, who all said, "Well, we're not really revolutionary," but turns out they are. There's kind of a change that happened. You know, when I was in school, you get history classes and they would say, you know, if you treat your people a certain way, you have a huge stratification. You have very rich and very poor, and the middle class gets squeezed or crushed. Sooner or later, you're going to have a revolt, maybe even a revolution. But these people in the Middle East said, no, this is very different. We don't do things that way here. But apparently they do, and no one really knows where it's going to go from here. There's a couple of different models of how it's developed. In Tunisia, where the young man, Mohamed Bouazizi, set himself on fire after the latest in many series of injustices that he faced, that had been an extremely quiet part of North Africa. The president, Ben Ali, had always presented a face of moderation, pro-civil rights, and he looked very good compared to his compatriots. While at home, he was running a very, very much of a police state, as most of the Arab states have been, and many still are. And in Egypt, the same model happened. This is sort of, there we go, this does work. Okay. The kind of the same model happened. You had a popular uprising. People were fed up with their daily living conditions and the endemic corruption that they could see all around them. And it worked as a peaceful, mostly peaceful uprising. Several hundred people killed in Egypt. but it worked because the Army was basically independent, an independent player, and was not inextricably linked to that particular leader. And they were able to tell Ben Ali, okay, you've got to go. They could tell Mubarak eventually, you've got to go. It took 2 weeks, but it worked. And you don't really have that so much in the other places around the Middle East. In the second model, of course, is Libya, where you had, he's probably the only leader, Gaddafi, who actually saw a lot of this coming. And 10 years ago, he started gutting his own army and replacing them with elite units of people that were run by his sons and were guaranteed to be loyal. And those are the people who are now leading the fight against the rebels. He also funded rebellions around Africa over the years and funded much of the African Union at the same time. So he's calling in those chips now and getting money and fuel and weapons from other African states and getting fighters from among those rebel groups who come and act as mercenaries there in Libya. But the other thing that happened in Libya is that half the country basically split off into rebel-controlled territory. The east is all rebel-held, and the west is largely, less and less now as time goes on, held by Gaddafi. So those are the two models we've seen so far. And now we get Syria, where they don't have either one of those factors. The opposition there, they don't have any base. They don't have a clear place to operate. The Syrian army can go anywhere it wants. And they also don't have an army that's likely to turn against Bashar al-Assad, the president there. He spent a long time, his father did, actually, Hafez, creating an elite largely populated by the Alawite minority, which he belongs to. And the majority Sunni population has always been a bit disenfranchised. But as a result, I mean, it's not just the army, it's the security forces, it's also the elite of society is largely populated by loyalists. So it'll be a lot harder to get them to turn against him. There's the occasional sign here and there, but it's going to be, if it happens, it'll be a much longer process. So that leaves these opposition people with fewer options. Plus, they have the problem that the Tunisian and the Egyptian opposition faces. They don't have any leaders, and they don't seem to want them at the moment. They don't trust the leaders in the diaspora outside, and they can't agree among themselves who should be their leaders on the inside. And that makes it very hard for the international community to come in and recognize anyone and say, okay, we can support you. Like they're even doing it in Libya, where the rebels are quite disorganized. But because they had that base and they managed to set up a council and they have managed to put together a plan that has satisfied the UN and the international community, they're now recognized as the legitimate authority in Libya over Gaddafi. That's not going to happen, I don't think, anytime soon in Syria. And he's taking his cues, Bashar al-Assad is taking his cues from neighboring Iran, which put down its own rebellion in 2009 after the elections that returned Ahmadinejad to power. And so their playbook is repress, talk reform, and repress in sort of alternating days. And part of that, I think, is because of what happened to Mubarak. When he did agree to step down, he was slapped in irons and now faces trial, which he probably should, considering what he did and his sons did over the years. But the message that sends to all of the other dictators out there is that compromise and stepping down is not really an option unless you want to be treated like this. So that makes, the further this goes on, the prospect of the peaceful revolution sweeping across all these countries becomes less and less. And now we're facing very, very difficult and sensitive issues. Syria in particular is in between Iran on the one hand, it's got Lebanon pretty much under its control through the Hezbollah militia that both Iran and Syria support, and it's of course very close to Israel, it borders Israel, so there's many things that can explode and go wrong if Bashar al-Assad falls, and that's what the diplomats around the world are now trying to wrestle with. What could come after him that's not going to cause this part of the Middle East to collapse or blow up? So let me tell you a little bit about why I think these two models started, the ones I spoke about earlier. In Egypt in particular, I know a bit more about there, lived there a long time. The army, one of the reasons it's so independent is that it's a major economic player. It just owns a lot of stuff. I remember taking my folks around in Luxor to see some of the tombs, and we were wandering around looking for lunch. We stop at this very nice hotel. We go in, and they show us the restaurant, and da 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 da. Oh, who owns this place? Oh, the police own this place. So that was a new thought of governing of ownership and private enterprise. But it's true all over. The army owns a huge cement company in Egypt. The Iranian Revolutionary Guard is a major, major player in both the nuclear supply field and in other construction fields and basically everything. Banking, you know, trying to get around sanctions, a lot of the way they've done it is by going through the Revolutionary Guard. So you have a strong economic incentive in some countries for these security services. In Egypt's case, that allowed them to say, okay, we don't really need Mubarak. In fact, he is now a threat to our economic interests and he needs to go. And what they're doing now is trying to hang on to those economic interests. And they're doing it, they still control everything, of course. The Supreme Military Council is creating these elections that they're going to have and will set the stage for the new constitution they're going to write. And I'd be very surprised if they wind up losing much power. The question is whether you can set up some kind of system that can evolve into a more democratic and representative system, given this starting point. I wouldn't say it's impossible, but it could go either way at this point, and a lot of the young revolutionaries who fill Tahrir Square are quite nervous about which way it's going to fall now. So I think that's another storyline to watch as the Arab Spring becomes the Arab Fall and keeps on going. Now, where else? I'm not going to give you a very long and comprehensive effort here. I would be very unfair of me. And I don't think I could be comprehensive. And if I was, you'd all leave in boredom. But we'll just mention a couple of other things. The last place I was covering, mostly long distance before I came here, was Syria. Most reporters nowadays are doing that from Beirut because it's very hard to get in, to get a visa to go in. I was down on the border with Turkey about a month ago, and I did go in for a couple of days and get smuggled in over smugglers' trails over these high mountain passes, and the people there were they're very mostly farmers, and they'd all been driven out of their villages. And when we showed up, they had many stories of they call them Shabiha, the paramilitary groups that the sort of plainclothed soldiers that they use in Syria had come and were infiltrating the houses, and the tanks had followed them, and then the shooting had started, and it was whole towns had just cleaned out, and they had come over these very high mountains to get into this valley, and on the other side was Turkey. And if they got into Turkey, they could get food, water, medical, and they'd be in a tent in a refugee camp, which was good. On the other hand, they couldn't see anyone, they couldn't leave, they weren't allowed to talk to reporters or their families. They had to, if they wanted to leave, they had to go back to Syria immediately. Turkey is one of a couple of countries that only accepts refugees from EU countries, oddly enough. The ones who are least likely don't want to come there, but I mean, to be fair, they do. The ones who do show up, they take care of them, but they have these restrictions. So it's a difficult time. But a lot of people, for that reason, had decided to stay right on the very edge of Syria. And we went in, some journalists, including myself, went in to talk to them. And that worked for a couple of days. And then the Syrian army showed up over the top of the hills from behind. So they all ran into Turkey. And that way into Syria was cut off for a while. So I really don't know which way Bashar is going to move on this. Some people say he's not even really in charge anymore, that it's his brother Maher, and it's really an opaque family-run enterprise, and it's a very difficult thing to to predict, but that, I think, I just found out today is where I'll be going back, at least to Lebanon and possibly into Syria, depending on visa issues. Probably be back to see what happens there in Syria next. I'll just touch briefly on some of the other countries that I've been to and enjoyed quite a bit. Yemen, which is just a beautiful, fascinating, and deeply screwed up country. Stuck there underneath Saudi Arabia on one side, and then just across the Gulf of Aden, there's Ethiopia and Eritrea and a lot of other troubled African countries. They don't have much in the way of unity. It's very tribal. They have no resources. They're almost out of water in Sana'a, the capital. There's at least two rebellions going on at any given time, and that was before the uprising. And now Saleh left only because he got bombed out of his palace and he was recuperating in Saudi Arabia. He may or may not be back. He claims he's coming back very soon. It's a haven for Sunni extremists, some of them loyal to Al-Qaeda, the local branch there. It's a very problematic issue, I think. It was considered almost a failed state for many, many years, and yet it just kept stumbling along. And the people, in fact, are wonderful. It's just a gorgeous country. The people are very friendly and nice, quite conservative, but very hospitable. Most of the Americans and the Europeans I know who went there just fell in love with the place and wanted to stay. But, as I say, it has all of these problems, and the government reach out in the hinterlands outside Sana'a is very limited. So it could easily become a haven for extremists, and it has been in the past. And this is what worries the Western intelligence and the Saudi Arabian intelligence people quite a lot. So I do wish them the best, but I don't know quite where they're going to go either. Over in the Gulf, the very first place I went in the Arab Spring, actually, was Bahrain. That was my good timing moment. I showed up the day before that uprising began, and it was very interesting to watch this majority Shiite population, which is run governed by a small Sunni minority, watch them bring their little protest that had been happening in their own villages into sort of, not exactly downtown, but they called it Pearl Square, the place where they wanted to be their Tahrir Square. And there was a bad crackdown. Then the moderates in the government took over and tried for a few weeks to achieve some kind of compromise and dialogue. And that didn't work. But in the meantime, the protesters had managed to control and get very large numbers in this Pearl Square. And then they were out. The Saudis moved in with their troops, and there was a very violent crackdown. Up to and including dragging patients out of hospital beds and arresting the doctors who had treated them, and all kinds of things that did not evoke much comment from Washington, oddly enough. They had been yelling about Libya and others, but not a word about Bahrain, mainly because of the Saudis next door and all of the oil that they need to keep flowing, and the security cooperation that they get sometimes from the Saudis. I noticed there's a new book just about to come out that talks about how the Saudis apparently were helping to fund Mr. bin Laden's organization just before 9/11. But they also have cooperated on other things, and they are an important ally of the U.S. And they were outraged at what happened to Mubarak. They consider him a good, loyal part of this team, which used to be the anti-communist team and is now the anti-Arab fundamentalist team, that gives them the support of the West that they have and they enjoy. And the West, of course, enjoys having the military access to that corner of the world, and also, of course, keeping the oil flowing. So there was really... I felt very sad for those people in Bahrain, actually. In a way, they were quite innocent. And there's really nothing that I don't think anyone's going to be doing for them in the near term. So this dialogue is now started again. I don't expect it to go very far, but the government says it's going to try. But really, the people over in Riyadh are calling the shots, so I'd say they're in a pretty tough spot. And of course, the reason that Saudi is so up on edge about this and so nervous is because on the other side is Iran. And Iran, which put down its own rebellion in 2009, is quite ambitious. It always has been. People in the Gulf, people in all across the Middle East will say, you Americans, you don't understand the Iranians. They're very crafty. They're incredibly smart. They make great deals. They think far ahead. And they are revolutionary. They mean to export their religious theocracy as far as it will go. On the other hand, they're also having a lot of problems at home. Their economy is in very bad shape. The president, Ahmadinejad, is quite unpopular, and he's gotten in a very public fight now with the supreme leader, Khamenei. It's a very opaque society, really difficult to know who's in charge at any given time, but all of these factors mean that the country's quite unstable, and that has everybody nervous. Not that they have a nuclear weapon now, but it does seem that there's a lot of circumstantial evidence that they're trying to have the capability, at least, to build one, should they decide to. And all of that, plus the weapons they already have, and their ambitions to be a regional power again, which they can do, they should be able to do more easily now that Iraq is much weaker and in disarray. So all of that leads to a very interesting set of circumstances there, because they're going to be having elections in a year or two, and how that goes may determine their next agenda for the next few coming years at a time when the whole region is in a lot of disarray. And I think I will open it up to questions, but, well, maybe I should mention just quickly Turkey, because I live there now, and it's becoming a very important player. It's Syria's biggest economic partner besides Iran at this point. Aleppo, the northern city, does huge business with Gaziantep and southeastern Turkey. The people just go back and forth across the border to use each other's airports. It's very open. And Turkey has been very circumspect up until recently in its criticism of Syria and Assad because they want to preserve these economic ties. But in the end, they're much more important to Syria than they are to Turkey. So we shall see how that develops. They have had, speaking of visa-free travel, they have this policy of visa-free travel, which has set up a very interesting triangle. You know, for the last 10 years, 1.3 million Iranians have come across their border with Turkey without a visa. And just a couple years ago, or last year, they started doing the same thing with Syria, which sets up kind of an interesting triangle of, of visa-free travel. But it's a very key player that doesn't seem to know which way it's going. The West is never quite certain if Erdogan, the Prime Minister of Turkey, is going to push his independent pro-Arab view any further than he already has. I mean, they're basically still a good NATO ally. They have NATO weapons on their soil, and it is often held up as a model, a kind of government for these Arab Spring governments who are now looking for a government. And I think it's a bit wishful thinking. Turkey does have an Islamic government that is very respectful of secular traditions and Western mores, but they got there from a very different point of view. When the Ottoman Empire collapsed, Ataturk made them that way. He said, okay, you were Muslim, now you're Western. Take off that fez, here's a bowler. You, madam, take off that scarf. You don't get anything to put on your head. And, you know, change your language, change the way you think. And man, he made them do it over a course of more than a century. And now, for the last 8 years, they have had a moderate Islamic government that has been eager to convince everybody that it can run the country and preserve, you know, the basic framework of the secular separation of church and state kind of government that Westerners approve of. And so far they've done it, but to say you can just take that and transplant it to these other Arab countries, I'm not so sure. I think that's a tougher stretch. I think it's a place that many of the intellectuals and the people who are behind some of these revolutions would like to get to. But how you get there from where they are is a tough question. So, anyhow, I'll stop there because I think the question is usually the best part. But thank you for coming out very much. And anybody wants to
Have a question? Have at it.
Peter,
hey.
You didn't mention Israel.
You're right.
And I'd be curious as to your perspective of how they fit in to the shifting dynamics.
Well, I mean, they're in the middle of it, and they're very nervous, needless to say. A lot of things are happening right around all of their borders. The Gaza-Egypt situation is very different. A lot of people think that the recent agreement between the Palestinian sides, Fatah and Hamas, came about because they had an agreement from Egypt that they were going to open the border at Gaza, which had been one of the big problems. Mubarak had been maintaining the blockade and the siege of Gaza along with the Israelis. And it was something he continued to do no matter what happened between Egypt and Israel. The Iranian situation has always had Israel very nervous. They're always considered, you know, if the U.S. doesn't do something, Israel is the only other country that might. But frankly, the situation, the Arab-Israeli conflict, the Arab-Palestinian conflict, Israeli-Palestinian conflict, is essentially stagnant right now. The basic behavior hasn't changed. The Israelis are still building settlements. The Hamas guys are still plotting to throw some rockets over the border from Gaza. Hamas has not agreed to recognize Israel. They are trying to go to the UN, the Palestinians are, to get declared a state by the larger general, the General Assembly. They couldn't get that through the Security Council because of the U.S. veto. But they will try to do it at the General Assembly, possibly, in September. That could be coming up fairly soon. I don't think that will change the fundamental nature of the conflict in any way, but it will give a lot of pundits something to talk about for the winter.
What's your take on when the U.S. troops will have gone completely from Iraq and Afghanistan?
My take on when it will happen or what that will mean? That has got a lot of people in the Pentagon quite worried because of what's happening all around. I mean, Iraq, of course, is between Iran. It borders with Syria. There's the Turks and the Kurds problem in the north. And without much of a U.S. presence, it will be that much harder to react if anything really bad goes wrong. The problem is getting a supposedly independent Iraq to agree to this. There are domestic pressures on Maliki from the Sadrists, the Shiite group that's would like to be basically another Hezbollah if they could work it out, but they're not quite that competent yet. They are extremely anti-American troop presence, and they want them out. And there's that pressure coming on Maliki domestically. And then there's also the pressure from Iran, which wants as clear a playing field as it can get in Baghdad and would love to have all of those troops gone. There is an argument that Maliki might do better personally if he had some American help. But politically, it's going to be very hard for him to get a consensus to agree to that. So, yeah, I think they will try to leave some. They need to find a very quiet sort of face-saving way to do it. And I don't think they've done that yet. But it's possible everybody will come out. And there's an argument that, from an American point of view, that might be a good thing. That argument goes, you know, whenever you pull out, it might collapse. So you can stay for 10 years, pull out, and then it'll collapse in 10 years. You know, so the optimists would say, well, we would like to stay until it feels like it's not going to collapse. Well, if we ever reach that point, who knows? But right?
Peter, can you talk just a moment about the logistics of trying to report and file regularly from the war zones where you don't have contact maybe all the time with producers or your editors, but how do you get around safely or even get food or water when you're in the middle of a war zone?
Yeah, it can be very difficult. The obvious rules are, you know, try not to be in between the two sides. Try and you have to pick one, which limits you from the get-go because you don't get the other sides as well. So, I mean, ideally, you can somehow over time get on both sides and see the way it's developing. As far as provisioning and getting around in logistics, Libya was my most recent kind of real experience of that. Benghazi, I mean, you just walked across the border from Cairo. There was nobody there. There's people on the Egyptian side, but nobody on the Libyan side. And then it's a 6-8 hour drive into Benghazi, which was the rebel capital. And then there was the front, which would just sort of float back and forth. There's a town called Ajdabiya. There's another, then a couple of oil ports called Brega and Ras Lanuf. And the front, since I was there earlier in the spring, has been basically floating this way and that way. And it wasn't always clear, and it moved very quickly at some times. So, you know, the rule that I like to follow, which is basically keep one town between you and the front at all times, is not always easy to follow because it moves around a lot. And I remember one day going up to Ras Lanuf, the oil terminal, and getting out of our car, and I saw, who was it? I think it was Tyler Hicks, the photographer for the New York Times, who's known as for being just completely fearless and always being right on the edge of the front with the bullets flying. And I said, wait a minute, what are you doing here? I'm in the wrong place. But, and I was talking in the hotel the next day to Anthony Shadid, the New York Times correspondent, and I was heading out at that point, being relieved by another reporter, and he was doing another daily run towards the front, and that was the day, as it turned out, that he and Tyler and two others got captured and were held for the better part of a week. So the unexpected can happen, although they admitted later that they didn't quite follow all their own rules, and they were in a place where they probably shouldn't have been. But, you know, in a war you can't ever really predict. You take precautions, but there's no guarantee that they're going to work. Food, I think, now is a problem in the west of Libya. I haaven't experienced this. My colleague, Lourdes Garcia Navarro, is there now. And she was living on cans of tuna for several days a couple of weeks ago, but it's a little better now. Because the fighting has been, a lot of the food was coming in from Tunisia, and the fighting was on the roads between Tunisia and Libya. That actually now is a problem for Gaddafi, because Tripoli is now, could be cut off if this one town, Zawiya, falls, where they're fighting right now. Tripoli, the capital, could be cut off from one of its major supply lines. Yeah.
Yeah. Who's funding the rebels in
Libya? They are getting supposedly non-lethal equipment from Britain, NATO. We have also acknowledged, I believe, Pentagon or State has acknowledged sending equipment, not weapons. But weapons are also getting in. No one is quite admitting to being the supplier, but I do know that a lot of those little boats that leave the Benghazi harbor and go to Misrata, which is now under rebel control on the eastern side, a lot of those boats, a lot of them look like fishing boats, they are carrying weapons. I don't think personally that they have what it takes to I don't think they have the equipment or the training or the personnel to actually take Tripoli militarily. I think what they're hoping is that if they keep the pressure on, more cracks will begin to show in the Gaddafi regime. A very high level official supposedly just arrived yesterday, day before, in Cairo. Defecting interior minister, I believe, one of the assistant, maybe. But it could happen that way. But yeah, these rebels are not all that well organized, but they have gradually, and the killing of the general there a couple of weeks ago, that was a real dangerous sign that this of a power struggle within the rebels, which could derail a lot of this, what had been a fairly optimistic feeling for them. But
a guy in one of the war colleges wrote a book a couple of years ago called The Shia Revival.
Saleh Nasser, was that him? Anyway.
Could be, eh?
Yeah.
In which he said that the Sunnis have been kicking the Shia around for about 1,000 years, and their Iranian nuclear stuff is more to tell the Sunnis never again than it is aimed at Israel. What do you think about that?
That's a reasonable scenario. It's part of it. I mean, it's certainly not all of it, but it's also to tell anyone else. I mean, the Iranians look at interventions. They look what happened in Libya. They look at what happened elsewhere, Kosovo, anywhere. It's just not really a religious or Muslim thing at that level. It's more of a strategic question. And then they look at what happens to North Korea or Pakistan or countries that have nukes, and they don't get invaded. And that's one lesson that I think that Iran has taken, Iran's leadership has taken to heart. It's actually very difficult for them to acquire these weapons, a lot harder than some people have been saying. Before all this Arab Spring started, my beat was supposed to be Iran and the nuclear issue, and I went to Geneva and boned up on the Atomic Energy Agency stuff. And it's actually the restrictions on the material they're getting. It's not so much the enriched uranium that can do that over time. They can get enough uranium. The problem is the other parts to make a missile, and configuring the uranium into a shape that can be delivered safely without blowing yourself up. But that's apparently that's the hard part, and they're not very close to that. But yeah, the sectarian. You talk to people all over the Gulf and in the Sunni countries, and they will try to tell you that sectarianism is not a part of this, that we were all brothers and we all lived together. And occasionally that's true. In Iraq, that was very true for a long time, for instance. But there is always this sectarian undercurrent, and it could flare up at times. And it, the Iranians will tell you the same thing. They will say, no, this isn't sectarian. We are an Islamic revolution. But in fact, they're very much a Shiite revolution, and that has not got them any friends in the Sunni majority countries.
Roger. Peter, this is pretty basic, but do you figure out your itinerary? Does somebody else tell you where you should be going, and do you have an interpreter with you at all times?
I tend to figure out a lot of it. Occasionally, you know, people like Gaddafi figure it out for me, but or revolutionaries on the streets. But yeah, I get a lot of leeway. My editors are very knowledgeable about the Middle East. I mean, between them, my two most immediate editors probably have 50, 60 years experience in the Middle East, so they understand the story very well. And they're pretty helpful at pointing me in various directions. But they, you know, from their own time in the field, they've taken up the philosophy that it's the person who's closest that has the best input on what the next story should be. As a translator, yes, most of the time. I mean, my Arabic was never good enough, really, and certainly not my Turkish. But there a lot of correspondence, you know, you live and die on the strengths of your translator. I mean, they're not just changing the languages, they're interpreting different worldviews for you and helping you understand different mindsets. I mean, there are a lot of things that just don't translate literally. And a really good translator can go through a very long spiel from someone who's very impassioned and can turn it into either American or British kind of English idiom that will help you understand what the person really means. I mean, if we reported literally what a lot of these people were saying, it would just make no sense, because they're speaking colloquially, they like we do in English. We have lots of sayings that, if we translated them into French, would make no sense, or into Arabic, certainly. But yeah, translators are very important.
I know that for a long time, the United States has been giving a lot of military aid to Egypt, and I figure that some of that would have to be like officer exchange kind of, or officer training and stuff like that. So, and I mean, I haven't really looked into this, but I'm wondering if that probably had a an impact on the military not siding with Musharraf.
With Mubarak. I don't know. That's an interesting question. Clearly, these exchange programs do have an effect on individual officers. Whether it translates to a whole change in a military way of thinking, I don't know. I think the economic issue was really prevalent in Egypt, in particular. That case is, I mean, they make a lot of money, and they really want to hang on to that. But yeah, the exchange programs are, you know, kind of interesting, and it's all very retail level. I mean, it depends on which Egyptian. Let's take the Egyptians. Which Egyptian officers meet with which American officers? You know, you could have some very interesting, lively, intellectual debates, or you could have people who just don't trust each other at all. You know, either way, But the and the weapons thing, of course, is not, as you probably all know, is largely geared towards our own defense industry. I mean, Egypt gets $1 billion a year, but they have to spend like 60-80% of it in the U.S. So that's a lot of the motivation for why that keeps continuing. Yeah.
Speaking of trust, can you see any way that the Middle Eastern, especially the Muslim population of the Middle East, and the U.S. will ever be able to trust each other? What takes us to that place?
Well, yeah, I mean, in some ways, I mean, it's a huge sweeping generalization to talk about whole populations like that, and obviously I can't do anything with any, you know, real conviction talk about, you know, because all the populations are different, but there is, the one thing I would hear, and I went over right after 9/11, it was my very first assignment, I was actually in Egypt getting reaction to 9/11, and it started then, but ever since, one of the main things that people were eager to have me understand is that they didn't hold my government against me. They didn't hate Americans, they just hated the foreign policy of the U.S. government. And to the extent that that's true, you know, some of that they're telling you what you want to hear. But I found over time that a lot of people really believe that. And you do see, you know, people-to-people exchanges happen at a much different and I think much better level, and you know, when you're dealing with governments and getting it from the media instead of seeing for yourself. I mean, we do the best we can, but you can't have any substitute for, you know, meeting someone who's foreign and strange and finding out that they're not that strange after all.
You're in radio and we've got the internet, which was big, it seems, and that's the whole Arab Spring. Could you just comment on that place of media and the internet?
Yeah, there was a great story. It just didn't happen to me, but I've talked to other reporters that who spoke to these people who were coming across the border, fleeing. Well, they fled Syria to go into Lebanon when the fighting happened up on Tal Khalaf there up on the border. And then a week or two later, they were trying to go home and check on their families and their stuff. And as they came back across the border, the question that they kept getting, what's that? Oh, that's my computer. Do you have a Facebook? No, I haven't got a Facebook. Okay, go ahead. So that was, these, you know, the local border guards didn't quite know what a Facebook was, but they knew it was bad. And it really has changed the game in a lot of ways. I noticed it actually in Morocco a couple of years ago. They would have occasional demonstrations, protests, and state TV would do nothing. State radio would say nothing. The papers wouldn't cover it. But what started to happen was people would be putting YouTube videos up, and they would be putting stuff up on their Facebook page. And it just drove the government crazy. They couldn't figure out how to stop it. And in Egypt, they tried to shut down the entire internet. I mean, which didn't work for too long. They have tried the same thing in Bahrain when I was there. They would, they didn't actually turn it off. They were a little more sophisticated. They targeted all of the opposition websites they could find, and then they slowed everybody else down to like dial-up speed. So it was really hard to upload videos, and that was how they did it. So they're trying. They're working on it. And now we're seeing countries like Saudi Arabia and the UAE and others, I think, too, are now threatening, cajoling, and making deals with people like Research in Motion, the folks who run BlackBerry, to get them to use data encryption that they know about and can decrypt the governments. I mean, because right now, they were going to ban it in the UAE. You wouldn't have to use your BlackBerry because, you know, it's encrypted back in Canada where Research in Motion is. And the government, they weren't going to let the government crack into this and spy on your communications. But now they've reached some kind of compromise, so you can assume that none of your emails are safe.
Yeah. I guess along those same lines, from where you're sitting from, how would you advise us to look at media, internet, radio reporting
and figure out what's truth anymore. I mean, as I'm thinking, there's the story of the person in the middle of the fight putting up the YouTube video, and they're the same person putting up a totally spinned something. I don't know if you have any additional insights on that. From
well, it's a good point. I mean, I don't have any clear-cut evidence, but just the fact that it's, you know, you can't really trace where these came from. What happens is you see over a period of time the same people are putting up these videos, and over time there's been some confirmation of what the past videos were what they claim to have been. Mainly what these are young Arabs, mostly Syrians lately are the ones I've been watching. They hold up their cell phone or their little camcorder and they say, you know, this is the third day of Ramadan and this is the town. And then they just let the thing go so you can see what's happening. But there are no guarantees in that, and that's why all of the media always says, and this video, which cannot be verified, purports to show X, Y, and Z. And it really is a handicap. I mean, if you can't, you know, a lot of war reporting is just some guy or gal out there in the zone saying, hey, I just saw these tanks go by, or, you know, there goes a rocket. And if you don't see it, it's harder to verify. And these videos are the only way that we're getting any information out of Syria, but death tolls, motivations, who shot first, who shot who, all of these things, a lot of that is going to be left to the historians. We actually just don't know at this point. Well,
Peter, do you see things changing 20 years or continuing civil unrest in all these nations?
Boy, predicting 20 years in the Middle East, I don't know. That's... I'd rather predict next year's fish run, but I think what you can say with some certainty, you know, everybody talks about the wall of fear, and that was what kept many of these populations quiet for so long. I mean, they are police states; they can be very thuggish, and once people got over their fear of that, I don't think you can put that genie back in the bottle. I don't think you can get them to go back to thinking that way again. And that's where these dictatorial regimes are going to have a very hard time in the long run. They're going to have an extremely hard time getting back to business as it was. The status quo ante, I don't think, is really recoverable. There may be isolated pockets. You know, Saudi Arabia will control the Gulf. They have added a couple of new states to this thing they call the Gulf Cooperation Council. They added two more monarchies, Jordan and Morocco, who are nowhere near the Gulf. But they are one of the lessons that they have learned from all of this is that it was the presidents and the prime ministers it was the elected leaders who all fell, the ones that have fallen so far. The monarchs are all still in power. None of those people have fallen yet. So, I don't know where it's going to go, but I think, yes, it will be the unrest and the push now for a better life, whether it means democracy or whether it just means better economic conditions, but the push for something better, I think, will absolutely continue. Sorry, somebody hasn't said yet. Go ahead, Beth. Boy, I don't know. That's a tough one. I have to say the close-up nature of the Bahrain uprising was very, in terms of the Arab Spring, was very compelling to me because we were in with these people as they broke through these barriers, and there was a moment when all the security guys who had their riot shields and their guns, and all of a sudden some order was given and they all ran for their trucks and sped away, and they knocked all the barricades over and ran into this downtown Pearl Square. I mean, that was a very heady moment, that it felt like you're really part of something. Unfortunately, it was all going to be crushed a few days later, and it was very sad, but watching people get over this fear of their government was a very educational thing for me. I enjoyed it. Yeah, go ahead.
Do countries, Russia, China, and the U.S., fighting their way in for democracy and or oil or whatever, does the United Nations play any part? Do you run into anybody from the United Nations in all your travels over there?
I do, yeah. The UN plays a part. It is very limited in what it can do, of course, under its charter. It has very, very slowly been gaining a little more power. But the dreams of Einstein and those guys back in the 50s who thought they were going to create a real world governing body, that has yet to emerge. They do play a role. They could have played a very big role in Iraq had it not been for that bombing in 2003 that killed DeMello, the leader there. And it caused them to just pull out completely for years. And they did come back. They're back there now, but in a much smaller way. Ban Ki-moon does the bully pulpit thing as best he can. He's all over the Libya situation and Syria. They have a very hard time at the Security Council because Russia and China are very suspicious. They were extremely opposed to the NATO bombing campaign in Libya. They're very worried that something like that could happen in Syria. They're very opposed to that. And they would veto, I think, even tougher sanctions at this point. But that would be the next step. If you can convince Russia and China to go for sanctions that target the oil and gas economy, for instance, that would send a real message to the Assad family that they were more isolated than they thought. I think the UN has a role to play. Unfortunately, they keep getting undermined, you know, by the Americans, by the Europeans, whenever the particular issue doesn't go their way. So it's one of those things that if everyone could get along and create a consensus, they might get somewhere. But at this point, I think they've got a tough road to hoe. Yeah, go ahead.
I was going to say... you might not be able to tell us in the future, but as for the past, how has your job changed, or the ability to do your job, I guess, with change in administration here?
Change in the U.S. government administration? Oh, well, I never had problems doing my job. You know, NPR comes under pressure every once in a while, and it doesn't really always have to do with who's in the White House. No, I have to say I have not felt constrained. I noticed sort of more of a self-censorship thing happening in Washington. You know, I did 6 years in Washington covering American politics, and at that time there's a very quality, I would say, of certain stories that we just don't do there, and there's certain kinds of things that just don't come up. And you know, I always felt that reporters, it's such source journalism, you have to be on good terms with your source to get that anonymous quote. It's such a difficult way to, you know, it's not, to me that doesn't feel like the right relationship, but you know, it results in some very good journalism, but also a lot of stories I think that don't get done. And to me, that is more problematic than anything I've encountered from the Americans on the foreign desk. Now, trying to get a visa to get in to cover some of these places from the foreign countries is another matter. But that was also one reason why I was eager to go overseas, was a chance to get away from sort of the professional media handlers and talk to real people again. That made a big difference to me. Oh, I will say, when I first walked into the desk and the foreign desk and told the editor, Lauren Jenkins, hey, I'd like to go overseas, and I immediately got a call from my friend Elizabeth Arnold, who, another Alaskan who works up in Anchorage now. She said, don't say that, he might send you to Jerusalem. There I was, 2 months later. But it all worked out for the best. Yeah, go ahead.
There was something briefly in the news about demonstrations in Israel, and large demonstrations.
Yeah, absolutely.
There was nothing about why, the reasons. Do you know anything about
Well, I haven't lived in Israel in many years, but I can tell you from my memories from then and from what I've read that it was economic largely. The nominal thing was the rent. Cost of rent was extremely high. Israel has always been, in some ways, the most first world of all the Middle East countries, but in others, if you don't have enough money, it is a very tough place to live. I mean, people get by on very little money. Housing issues, the housing now with people coming back from the diaspora and buying up properties, rents have gone very, very high. You can't build anymore in the old city, of course, because it's a historical place, but I mean, they build illegal buildings and they're stacking up the kids like cordwood. I mean, it's very hard to get an affordable place now if you don't have a big salary in Israel, and I think this is a it's a function of that. It's a quality of life issue. There is sort of a political issue, if you want, depending on how far you want to interpret it, because one of the arguments is that so much money is being spent on the security issue and protecting the settlers and, you know, keeping a presence in the West Bank, that all that money could be going to easing the lot of people in Israel proper. But mainly it's an economic thing. Yeah.
Regarding these groups who forced the protest, for example, in Egypt, like the Muslim fraternity, or Khamenei in like the opposite persons, like Khamenei in Iran, do you know what attitude or what opinions they have? Because in the Western media, I can only talk about the German media, they were always the positive persons, like the good ones. But are they really that good? Like, are they like?
Oh, you mean the opponents, like the Green Movement in Iran?
No, like, no. Like the Khamenei in
the
Iran.
Supreme leader.
Yeah, or the guys who led the protest in Egypt. Like, what are they? Are they really that much liberal as they are broadcasted in television over here?
I'm not sure I understand your question, but they. I can say that these opposition groups in Egypt and Tahrir Square, in Tunisia, in Libya, in Syria, we don't really know who they are, with the exception of Libya, where they have set out this council and they have a set generation of leaders that hopefully no more of them will get shot. But no, the movement in Egypt was quasi-organized by a youth group that kind of grew out of the labor movement. They used to have a lot of strikes over in Kobra al-Mahalla, and they organized some of the initial sit-ins in Tahrir Square, and which grew and exploded into what toppled eventually Mubarak. What's happening in Egypt is an explosion of political parties. The Muslim Brotherhood, which is always the big monolith, the only one that was allowed quasi to operate under the Mubarak regime, they have now split off. There's a new sort of moderate branch of them called Wasat. There's a youth movement that has its own ideas. And then there's the old hardliners. And then there's Salafists, who are the very hardline Sunnis, have suddenly popped up and are organizing themselves. So what that might mean is that the Islamist vote, you know, the people who want a theocracy in Egypt, are going to be split among all these different parties, and they will not have as much clout as some people fear. But the liberals are also split. I talked to one guy, a longtime activist, who said his hope is that this next election, which could happen this fall, maybe next spring, he hopes that nobody wins a big majority. He hopes that just everybody scatters to their own favorite party and everybody has a few seats, and then they can write a new constitution and then they can try again. That would be, I think, a good outcome if that could happen. We'll keep it to one or two more. I think it's almost about an hour already. Diane.
Thank you, Peter. Is there a hierarchy of your staff over there? I mean, do you have sources that you... So you can stay in Istanbul for a while and you have sources in these other locations that feed information to you?
I wish. I spent very few days in my own bed this year, unfortunately. But, yeah, in theory, you can do that for a little while. I mean, mainly, you know, they want you to go where things are happening. Syria, it's so tough right now, they will let you stay in Beirut for a while, but you're constantly applying for visas and hoping that it comes through. With the advent of the internet and these things, and frankly, in Syria, you're getting the best information on Skype now. Skype is the technology that is hardest, apparently, for the government to crack at this point. It's harder for them to trace where it's coming from. So, but it also requires extra diligence on the part of the journalist to make sure that you're talking to who you think you're talking to and where they say they are. So it requires a lot of triangulation. Go ahead.
Are there, just from your perspective, any countries that really may not be in the limelight, kind of flying under the radar, but are ones that we should be paying attention to?
I thought, and I've been wrong so far, I thought Algeria would have more of an uprising. So far, it seems, best I can tell from the journalists and the friends that I talked to there, they say that people are just so afraid, you know, though they've had two really horrible civil wars. I mean, when they get violent, they get really violent. It's horrible to even think about. So maybe people are just afraid afraid of triggering that again. But they have a very old leader, Bouteflika, who just think he can barely get up in the afternoon. They have to put him back to bed. And he's a puppet of the army, and the army can't decide who it wants next. So it's another one of those states where the army's in charge. And if I would have thought that something like that might have gone on. On the positive side, I think Morocco and Jordan might actually enact some real reforms here that could be more of a model for other states in the future if they can hang on. I mean, the king there, he's not going to give up power. He's still going to be able to appoint the parliament, but he has announced several new steps that I think are quite positive. And Jordan just announced a new constitutional framework that goes about halfway as far as people were hoping, but still it's a step in the right direction. Yeah, okay.
How do you feel Saudi Arabia's role in the Middle East as a peacekeeper?
Saudi Arabia's role, they are very much on the defensive now. They are hanging on to this agreement that they believed they had with the West, where they provide oil and some measure of stability, and in return they get protection, military protection and security protection from the West. There are some in Saudi Arabia now who don't believe that the U.S. has kept up its part of the bargain. They let Mubarak go, who was supposedly, you know, part of this same club, and they are under a certain amount of domestic pressure. They are also behind the scenes extremely active in trying to undermine Iran, and it's difficult for them because they have positioned themselves as the king there doesn't call himself the king, he's the custodian of the two mosques, Mecca and Medina. So they are positioning themselves as the keepers of Islam, which is supposed to be open to all sects and everybody, but in fact it is quite touchy when Shiites come in large numbers on the Hajj. And there was the 1979 takeover that was very bloody and still reverberates to this day in parts of Saudi Arabia. They are getting more and more forceful. The fact that they sent troops into Bahrain is unprecedented, unheard of. They have this fabulous military from all of this money they get from the U.S. And they never use it. And now they're starting to use it. And where that's going to lead, I'm not sure. But if they start to get more aggressive in their foreign policy, things could start to change rapidly. Yeah.
Kind of thinking about bringing this home. I'm a very self-centered person. You're talking about the religious problems of Sunnis and the Shia and the economic problems causing all these rebellions. You know, we're looking at our country where 4% of the people have half the wealth of the country, over 150 million people. And we have the fundamentalists really coming on strong, and all the vitreous and the new candidates, Perry and those guys running, you know, talking pretty uncomfortable stuff with, you know, reviving segregation and and you know, just a lot of tough issues that are, you know, that we fought before, and now it looks like we're going back to. It seems similar to what you're saying. These other countries are started their rebellions. Do you see, you know, Congress isn't working together, and, you know, we seem to be having a lot more problems. Do you see any of that rolling into this country?
Well, you're starting from a much better place. I mean, I have to say, there is no Arab country, no country in the Middle East or North Africa. I mean, outside of Israel, there's no Arab country that has any real kind of independent legislature that's capable of providing any checks and balances against the executive. I mean, they're all very top-down societies. And while I hear what you're saying, and then the echoes of you know, religious talk on the one hand and economic disparity, I mean, that's all true. But I think it's the feeling that they just have no avenue. And compared to what you have here, what we have here in America, they really don't have much so far. And that's what they're trying to get to with these revolutions. And if they succeed, then maybe you could start making some of those comparisons. But I don't think they've quite gotten, it's not apples to apples yet, I don't think.
So we're safe for a while. Yeah.
I can't promise anything. Anyway, okay, one more.
Okay. I was just wondering what you thought about the future of Florida, considering how corrupt your government is.
Yeah, it's, I'm a little bit optimistic, but, you know, I have to say, I once did a story about that very thing. Was Jordan the closest thing to a democracy in the Middle East? This is many years ago now. And I met a very interesting guy. He ran a pet shop down near the First Circle in Amman, and he was saying, you know, everyone calls us the nearest thing to a democracy, but the only difference, you know, I'm from Syria, it turns out. He was Syrian originally. He said, and the only difference between us and Syria is here you can see the political prisoners. Whereas in the, I mean, and as I arrived, you know, my first trip to Jordan was when King Abdullah just decided he didn't like what someone had said in Parliament, so he just dissolved it, and then he ruled by decree for the next year and a half. So this is the level where a lot of them are starting from, and you have to sort of take that into account when you're trying to do comparisons. But anyway, thank you all for coming. I really appreciate it.